Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Mona Shaw, I know today we're going to be talking about, well, a very timely topic, because there's been a lot of feedback, especially with the current administration, with problems at the consulate.
That's right, Mark. We are having issues, and unlike not just us, but I know almost each and every lawyer who deals with the consulate is having issues, and especially for EB5 applicants, because 80% of the applications do come through the consulate.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of those issues like? Because people mention it to me, I kind of smile and nod. You know, if it sounds like something that we've talked about before, I may know what they're talking about, but I'm not the immigration professional. So give us a little bit more on some of the typical problems that people are seeing.
So the big issues which we're actually going to discuss in today's podcast is this nasty word called administrative processing. When you go to the consulate for your visa, et cetera, you do expect that you'll take your passport and get stamped and you'll go away,
right,
smiling and happy. And instead, the consulate officer tells you, sorry, but we've just put your case through administrative processing. And then we get the calls and the calls and the calls. So admin processing is a topic we wanted to discuss today.
And Mona, you recently have added someone to your team that's going to be on today's show and helping us with this topic, right?
That's right. We are very excited, actually, to welcome to our team Ramin Asgard.
Hey, Ramin.
Hi, Mark. And thank you, Mona.
Ramin, as a member of the MSA Global team, please go ahead and introduce yourself.
Thank you so much, Mona. I'm really excited to be part of Mona Shaw and Associates, Mona Shaw Global. What I bring to Mona Shaw is exactly on point with what we're discussing today. I was a former U.S. Department of State Foreign Service officer and a consular officer. So that mean guy at the window that would announce that you need administrative processing, yes, unfortunately, many times that was me.
I think you were a consular officer for quite some years.
Yes, maybe. Yes, many thousands of people I've been unfortunately breaking that news to. And I'm really pleased to be here today to give insight both into what happens out there in the field at the embassies and consulates, as well as what happens back in Washington as part of this process. And finally, excited to be back at my natural home as an immigration attorney and with such a stellar exemplar of the profession as Mona. Very, very happy to be here.
I told you it was good, Mark.
It sounds great, especially when we're talking about all these problems at the consulate. And you're like, yeah. Oh, yeah, Mark, we just brought somebody onto our team who knows exactly this because they have been on that side of the glass, as it were.
Right.
It's so great to have you on.
Yes, you've heard that the big issue is administrative processing, Ramin, but before we really go on about what to do, how to deal with things, I think the audience really need to understand what admin processing is, because I have to admit, once it first happened to me, I had to really go out and look it up.
That's exactly right, Mona. It's not supposed to be something that's known. Actually, administrative processing is formally the euphemism that State Department Foreign Service and consular officers use when a case is required to get some additional screening, whether they do it at the embassy or a consulate, or whether they have to send it back to Washington. What they're supposed to tell the applicant and their attorney, by the way, is that it has been referred to administrative processing, not any details on why it's been.
I think he's just piqued everyone's ears that's listening to them right now. Wait a minute. They tell the clients and the attorneys this? I've heard this term before. Now what's happening?
That's right. But why now? Why are we seeing every case? For example, I'll give you a couple of examples, Ramin. We have a dozen or so people sitting at the Mumbai consulate in India. every single case has been put on hold. It's in administrative processing. And these are amazing applications. There's no issue with the regional centers. There's no issues with the applicants. Their source of funds are fantastic. And yet still they're in administrative processing. And it's not just the EB-5 cases. Our non-immigrant visas are there. Why?
Well, that's an excellent question.
If you have an answer.
I do have an answer. Actually, there are several ways that a case can go to administrative processing. And it's important to note that some of them are the discretion of the consular officer. If there's something that they see that they just want some extra time to look through, they may issue what's called a 221G. And they may just ask for some additional documents or discuss it with the consular chief or make some telephone calls to confirm some information. And that's at the post. That's usually resolved very quickly. The administrative processings that take longer are the ones that are referred back to Washington. Those are the ones that are intentionally mysterious and not much information is available on them. It's important to note, and I'm not sticking up for my old crew of consular officers, but generally, those referrals back to Washington are not discretionary. In other words, if something is in the case that requires the case to be sent back to Washington for a review, it's mandatory.
Oh, so the word 221G stamped on your passport is not a terrible thing. It's not like a big black mark.
No, absolutely not. In fact, 221G means that you've passed through all the hoops of statutory approval. It's just that there is some additional material, either documentation or information needed before the consular officer issues the visa. They want to issue the visa, but they just need either for mandatory reasons or occasionally they'll want to check a few things out or ask for a document that might be unclear or missing for some additional information before they can go ahead and issue. But overall, that means the application's in good shape.
Okay, well, we've been doing EB-5 for many years and we didn't really have any issues in the Obama administration. Really, we didn't have anything. And we were able to contact the consulate quite easily. It has changed a lot since we've got this current administration in. And I'm not being political here. This is factual.
Yes. One of the things is that technology has advanced and the amount of information that's collected on applicants right now is much higher than it used to be. There was a form introduced called the DS-5535, which asks a lot of information, and we can get into it in detail if there's interest. But among those are all of your social media platforms and identifiers over the last 5 years. You can imagine when someone provides that, how much data and information that generates that then has to be sifted through.
Yeah, well, I have to say there is interest in the magic DS-5535 because I know a lot of people really are not aware of this. This was just recently introduced, right? It's a special vetting.
Yes, it's a form that was introduced in May, actually, of 2017.
Ah, that makes sense. And the timing matches about a lot of times when a lot of our cases stalled.
Absolutely. When you hear the term extreme vetting, what extreme vetting is about is vetting a lot more information than what was available to consular officers in the past. And that's a technology issue. That's not necessarily a political issue. It's that the current administration is taking maximum advantage of the available technology to gather information.
Ramin, what kind of information are they looking for in this form?
Oh, gosh, it asks for your travel history, your address history, your employment history for the last 15 years.
Oh, wow.
And the social media platforms and identifiers are a big part of it. And then it asks for all your contact information for the last 15 years. One of the things we try to do is we do that form in advance. In other words, we don't wait until it's asked for. That way, if it's possible, if there's something in there that the consular officer wants to know, we would rather have them have it on the spot at the interview rather than ask it and then go to our client and say, hey, here's an additional step for you.
But our clients aren't really asked these questions. How do they get this information?
In general, what they do is when they get put into administrative processing, if they get put into administrative processing, one of the things that they generally do ask for is this new form. Now, there are clients from certain countries that automatically are required to submit this form when they apply.
But is this form utilized at all consulates, or is it just at certain consulates?
It's used at all consulates, but it's predominantly applied to certain nationalities. Or if the consular officer has...
That sounds a bias.
It can be viewed that way, but it's there are many reasons why a case may be referred for what's called a security advisory opinion. That's the non-euphemistic term for administrative processing in most cases. And one of them is country of nationality, but there are several others.
We do have a number of cases which were at the London consulate, at the US Embassy in London, and they were heavily delayed. So would that be because, and these were for British nationals, but I believe the place of birth of the British nationals was not Britain. So would that be a trigger?
That can be a trigger, is the country of the person's birth. But there are other triggers, Mona. I just want to quickly list a few of them. I mean, consular officers review a database, a name database, that provides very basic bio information about each applicant. If your name happens to be a common name, which can trigger a hit on that database, kind of like the no-fly list and those kinds of things, mm-hmm. If you have a common name, it's possible that it has nothing to do with you, but before you can be issued a visa, that name hit has to be resolved. A couple of the other things, if there's a technology export concern, if you're coming to the United States with
a technology export concern?
Yes, a technology
All right,
export
please
concern.
Explain.
Well, if you're coming to the United States with an education or a professional background in a sensitive technology, usually these are technologies which have military applications of some sort. Nuclear engineering, biochemical engineering, those kinds of things. Then again, there's a requirement that a check be run to ensure that there's no export control risk. That may have nothing to do with your nationality. And so that's another reason why sometimes cases are referred to administrative processing.
Okay. Well, what about the fact that many of the applicants, many of our clients have complained that they have gone to the consulate and the consular officer has not understood EB-5 and has asked them what we would call silly questions or questions outside of the purview of what we would consider a consular officer should have asked.
Mona, could you give me an example of what you think a silly question would be?
So, for example, one of our clients who, he's an entrepreneur in his own project, and the consular officer said, oh, I'm not sure whether this is approvable because it's not a regional center. And as it is, the law was the prior to regional centers
prior,
was there.
Right.
Yeah, a long time. The EB-5 law was there since the 80s. So, you know, why would a consular officer even mention this?
Right. Well, let me give you a picture of the day of a consular officer.
He's getting defensive. It's okay.
Yeah.
You take your post there at the window at 8 a.m. And then you get 200 people in the waiting room and you process through those interviews in roughly 3 minutes each. And that's the only way you get through them. 95% of them are fairly routine. Every once in a while, an EB-5 or a complex employment-based visa comes in, and you may or may not have received a lot of training in that particular area, and your knowledge may be fairly limited. So sometimes what happens is consular officers use their best judgment based on the knowledge that they have, and sometimes when, for whatever reason, they get a little bit confused about what they're hearing back from the applicant. What happens is something triggers in them that gets them into the, I'm doubtful now, I'm going to ask a bunch of questions.
And that's when we get annoyed.
And they do. They ask, how long have you lived here? How long did you work there? Why did you marry this person and not that person? What is really happening is the consular officer is struggling during that 3 minute window that they have to kind of find a safe place where they feel authoritative again, because no, they're not really sure. And so they're fishing a little bit for grounds where they can refuse the visa or give a 221G where they don't have to get into the technical aspects of the EB-5, which they're not as familiar with.
Okay, well, the other issue that we have is fine. If they have to go and do their extreme vetting and the whatever reading they have to do, there should be a certain timeline. I know there is a guidance, but some of our clients have been stuck in admin processing for what seems like an eternity. And on the other side, the uncertainty is really a problem because jobs, schools, other issues, everything is just up in the air. Is there any way we can deal with this? I know that personally, I've been to the Dubai consulate where you were actually for some years. And I walked in with a lot of arrogance, thinking that, you know, I'm a US attorney and blah, 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 go up to the window. And then I was humbled almost immediately with a go away. We don't want to see you. So, you know, seriously, how can we do anything or what can we do?
There are steps that you can take for finding out. Remember that just as the consular officer has this mandatory requirement to submit for screening, if something happens that triggers the necessity of administrative processing, no one really is obliged outside, back at Maine State, where I also spent several years, to give a lot of authoritative or complete answers to an attorney inquiry or an applicant inquiry.
That's a nice way of saying we don't care.
And no, it's not that they don't care. It's that, again, I'm not defending the old folks there, but they can't necessarily provide information if there's an ongoing check happening. And that ongoing check may involve several agencies besides the State Department that the State Department is not completely aware of where they may be in their research. It may involve people like Department of Homeland Security, FBI, and others. And so the State Department exercises a coordination role, but they don't necessarily have a 360-degree perspective on what everyone else is looking at as they evaluate the security advisory opinion.
But what about the timing?
Well, timing-wise, generally the guidance that the State Department provides is that you should wait 60 days.
Never happens.
And then make a never happens that it takes 60 days?
It takes a lot much longer
of,
than
60. Of course. So,
or it has been, rather. I shouldn't say it has been.
Notionally, that probably is applicable for post-specific administrative processing. But when it comes back to Washington, you're absolutely right. It often doesn't resolve within 60 days. So the steps to take, you inquire with the embassy or consulate directly.
That's who? For the attorneys or for the applicant themselves?
The applicant can inquire, but the attorney can also inquire. With a G28, they can certainly make an inquiry on behalf of their client. Then you request information directly with the office that's exercising that coordination role, back at the State Department in Washington. And that office is Consular Affairs Bureau, Visa Office, Legal Division, Coordination. And there's a number there and emails there on the websites that you can find, but they're available publicly.
Ramin, is that a number, a legitimate number there that we can call and somebody picks up and answers? Or is it like your 1-800 number for USCIS where you're really talking to somebody who doesn't really give you any answers?
Unfortunately,
I'm very skeptical, as you can hear, Mark.
No, it's fair enough, fair enough. What we're going over now is what the standard approach is.
Okay.
And that sometimes works, sometimes doesn't. You can escalate. You can, for example, if you have a compelling circumstance that really necessitates that irreparable harm would be caused if time passes. In the case, not EB-5 cases, but in immediate relative immigrant cases, they have a 30-day requirement to adjudicate the case, including any security advisory opinion. So if you go back to them after 30 days and they haven't done it, then you have a cause to say you haven't met your target. And this is causing a real serious problem. Another thing you can do, and people do frequently, is they get a congressman or a senator involved. That usually is about the same time they're making these inquiries. And again, that's at the 60-90-day mark.
Okay. So yes. we have, unfortunately, a client who was put into administrative processing because the officer didn't know what an O visa was. Fortunately, this was Dubai. And it took 17 months for them to get back to her. You know, that was 17 months where she was just waiting, and with no indication whether the U.S. company would still hold the job open for her. You know, that situation seems ridiculous.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there are a couple options you can take in cases like that. One of them is that if there are new factors, or if there's manifest error by the agency, in this case, the State Department consular officer didn't know what an O visa was, as you're saying, you can apply again. You can submit a new visa application and point out either the compelling new information or the manifest error by the agency. And generally, that will result in some action.
But that mean that you would have to go through the fees and all of the DS forms again?
Yes, you would. But it's not that you have to go back all the way to the petition stage, but you do have to go to the consular processing stage of filing the non-immigrant visa or immigrant visa application again.
Yes, Ramin, I know. We have cases where we have told our clients to go to the local congressman and senator's office, and they've produced a letter, and the senator's office or the congressman's office or even the state senator's office has come back and said, oh, it's in administrative processing, there's nothing you can do. So I feel like that is a useless option. What next? Do we really have to do an action in one of the courts, in one of the federal courts?
I mean, if you have gotten, Mona, to the point where you've tried everything that's out there, we ran through several, then you do have the right to file a writ of mandamus in federal court.
Yeah.
And what you're essentially doing is you're commanding the Department of State and the consular officer and the post and anyone else you feel like including that's appropriate to do their job. And their job is to adjudicate the visa application.
Okay, but if there is always an idea that if we file a mandamus action, and it has been done, that there is some kind of retribution because there will be either a denial or what's called an RFE or some response that really is not favorable.
Well, the mandamus doesn't necessarily net you an approval. It nets you a decision. So in filing the mandamus, the general strategy that seems to be the best is to actually, when you're at the end of your rope of all these other steps, submit the draft writ of mandamus to the Department of State and say, we will be going forward with this action in X number of days unless some measure is taken to reach final decision on this case. In most of the cases, they reach a final decision. Do they always approve in that case?
Well,
no.
We found that it isn't always the most helpful. And we've avoided it where we could.
Right. It is a last resort. And, you know, in the case where you have no choice but to do that, you want to be a proactive for your client.
No, absolutely. We will fight for our clients, etc. But if this, as the saying goes, if we can obtain the result with honey, we'd rather do it that way.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the idea is you want to do everything you possibly can do to work this out amicably because you have a relationship that you cultivate with the Department of State.
Right.
A wonderful government agency, by the way. You have a relationship that you cultivate with embassies and consulates overseas, and you don't want to put those people on the other side of litigation unless there's really, really no alternative.
Mona, it sounds like you both have what I'll call like on the deck plate experience, and you two have been on either side of the window and really battling that out. Well, you can definitely tell between the back and forth between the two of you that obviously, there's some contention on how things work, some, we'll say, probing questions and general understanding on this is the way things should be. And since you both have done this so many times over the years on either side of the glass, you remember the outliers. You know, maybe they all run smooth, but it's the outliers that you remember. And it sounds like it's a balancing act between essentially what I'll unaffectionately call visa transactions, you know, the transactional basis of this client needs to get through this hurdle. Maybe they have another hurdle in 6 months, 5 years. I've got another client here. So between that and the working relationships of essentially two professionals that know their job and probably like their job. And Ramin, you've already complimented your last employer, so it sounds like you haven't burned any bridges. Things don't work out here with Monashaw & Associates, so you've got that going back. You know, I know I'm rambling a lot, but let me just ask you, why don't most attorneys do this direct inquiry? Why don't they actually get to the deck plate level and do what you've both have done many times in the past?
Attorneys should and do make inquiries. The challenging part is a lot of times they get very boilerplate, non-responsive answers to those inquiries.
You that, don't say.
That really, yeah.
I'm sorry.
Come on, you two are on the same team now.
Yeah, and that does happen, and that's because a lot of the process, I mean, you're talking about enormous volumes of inquiries, and they're, unfortunately, it's very challenging to give personalized attention to each and every inquiry, and so many of them will automate the responses and they get a response that doesn't really help them very much.
So then I think Mark really was asking, what should be done then?
Yeah, so if most, thank you, Mona. If most get the canned response because you are overwhelmed, you painted the picture earlier, you clock in at 8 in the morning, you've got 300 people in the lobby there, and you start working through them. And if you get these inquiries from immigration attorneys later down the road, you may send a canned response, which may or may not answer the question. But what's to be done then?
Well, I mean, it's important to keep this in perspective, Mark. For the client, the only case they care about is their case. And so they're willing to slash and burn and do anything to get a result, positive result in their case. And in general, we do that too. We fight for them in every way we can. On the other hand, we have a relationship that we cultivate with these agencies over years. And what we would like to do is to build up a relationship so that we're not talking to a computer, we're not talking to an automated database, but we're talking to a human being. What we do is, with the relationships that we have established, with the collegiality that we have with these government agencies, in part due to our lengthy experience in the trenches with those agencies, we then engage on a collegial level, on a human level, on a relationship level, to deal with that client's case, and perhaps cases like that client's case, so that we get a clear answer, a clear path forward, and that we can be responsive to both our client's needs, but also to the equities of that relationship in both directions.
Well, Mark, you can see, and I suppose our audience can really see, that this can be a very challenging area. There is one point, though, I would like to make with our EB-5 applicants. And many times people don't realize this, is that they are often guaranteed that they would have a return of their funds if their I-526 or the first petition is denied. But if they are denied at the consular level, there's no recourse. They do not get a return of their funds. And often this stage is overlooked. So I feel that this is something which is important for everybody to understand, that this can be challenging. And there are issues which are coming up daily, I would say. Would you not agree?
Yes, absolutely. The consular stage is, for a lot of people, is a mystery, can be really daunting, and helping them through that stage, it should absolutely, positively not be taken for granted.
So I know a lot of EB-5 petitions, the initial 526, are perhaps filed by the in-house immigration attorney at Immigration Council for Regional Center. And obviously, they have lots of experience doing the initial 526 petition. But some of these consular, we'll call them hurdles. They might not have the kind of experience that the both of you are talking about. It sounds like that's a risk, right?
It is. Well, I'm not here to sort of knock in-house counsel. They often do a very good job. But this is an area that people do overlook. The in-house counsel don't always have the experience at the next level.
Right. And we're not knocking them. We're just saying, hey, listen to this episode. If you understood it, great. If not, go back, re-listen to it. It'll help you and your clients out. So, Mona, Ramin, thank you so much. It's been a great episode of EB-5 Investment Voice. And next time, we'll have to come back on and talk about this travel ban.
Thank you, Mark.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you for being with us today on EB-5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB-5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB-5 Investment Voice.